from the Sky News Centre at 6. The mother of two little boys who died in a suspected hit-and-run in Coventry has described them as amazing and says they'll be deeply missed. Louise Platt May was walking with Corey and Casper when they were hit by a car yesterday. Two people are still being questioned by police about the collision. Chelsea Platt May is the auntie to the 6 and 2-year-olds and was also there when it happened.
It sounds sad and horrible to say, but I hope that they didn't suffer and I hope they were gone with happy thoughts and not thoughts of pain.
Sinister directors at Toys R Us have told the Pension Protection Fund they're preparing to appoint administrators early next week. The move will put more than 3,000 jobs across the UK at risk. A charity says Stephen Fry's announcement that he's been treated for prostate cancer could encourage more men to get checked out. The TV presenter had surgery last month and says it went well. Former BHS owner Dominic Chappelle has been ordered to pay nearly £90,000 after failing to provide information to regulators. Investigators had asked him for details about the firm's pension schemes following its collapse in 2016, leaving thousands of people without jobs. He says he now plans to challenge that ruling.
It's not the outcome we'd wish for. The sentence was harsh. However, we have already lodged an appeal. We did that a month ago, or immediately after the original trial. It would be inappropriate we say anything further until the appeal, which we can run on a much more technical basis.
In sport, Manchester City boss Pep Guardiola has been charged with wearing a political message. He's broken Football Association rules by pinning a yellow ribbon to his clothes in support of Catalan independence. When asked about it last year, he said it was to show solidarity after two members of its government were imprisoned following a disputed referendum. That's the latest. I'm Charlie Max.
Love Bristol.
Love, love, love.
BCFM 93.2.
His name's Steve Satan and he's on your radio.
It's the politics show.
He's good and wholesome, but it ain't the Christian show.
It's the same old theme tune. Different presenter this week. Tony Gosling is still on holiday for another 3 weeks, I think. Biddy's been in the hot seat for the last three, and I'm Steve Satan for this week and the following two. So who have we got in the studio tonight? Well, the usual guest, Martin Summers, the allegedly Oxford alleged economist. We'll challenge him about that later, possibly. And we've got a couple of councillors in the house. Labour councillor Steve Pearce, and in the interest of balance, we've also got Labour councillor Mark Bradshaw. You might think that's a little unfair, but we it's just the luck of the draw, really. We had Conservative Jeff Gollop on the show last week, and no doubt we'll have many Tories and Lib Dems and Greens in the weeks to come. So, what's been happening there? Well, there was this big sort of budget hoo-ha. The Lib Dems aren't happy, the Greens aren't happy, and they're accusing Labour of doing everything wrong, but then they would, I suppose. We'll find out a little bit more about that later. Well, very soon, actually, and there's all sorts of other Bristol news. We'll sort of cross that bridge as we come to you. I've got 26 pages of notes, which is probably a little bit excessive, but it's better to be safe than sorry, I think. So, let's turn to my guest, Steve Pearce, on my left. What do you do?
What do I do?
Yeah.
Well, I'm the local ward councillor, one of the ward councillors for St George Central, just up the road from the radio station.
So you walked here then, did you? Is it a short walk?
No, I caught the bus. So I'm a local ward councillor and I sit on the licensing committee and I sit on the scrutiny committee. And I sit on the scrutiny committee for the West of England, and I dabble a bit in transport. I provide a bit of support to the cabinet member for transport.
Transport? We might talk about that in a minute. So, I mean, how much time out of your life does that take? It's not a full-time job, is it?
Interesting thing about being a councillor is that it will expand to fill all available space. I took early retirement about 10 years ago when I was made redundant, and I ran a couple of charities for a few years and then got involved in electoral politics. And as soon as anybody hears that, oh, You're retired, are you, Steve? Well, you can do this and you can do that, and we'll give you something else to do.
Right.
But it does fill all available space. So.
You sort of fit the cliche, was that like when you get retired, you wonder how you ever found the time to do work. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. People used to say that. People that retired from work used to say that to me, and it used to annoy me intensely. And I'm one
until
of
it happens
people,
to you.
And now I'm one of those people now.
Okay, and what did you do before you became a councillor? What was your profession?
I worked in the chemical industry for 29 years.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
As an actual chemist, are you good on chemistry?
29 years of shift work.
Oh, right, okay.
And 29 hours of 12-hour days and 12-hour nights.
Yeah.
And I turned 50, and they made me an offer I couldn't refuse.
Right.
And actually, it was as well that they did, because I was finding the job increasingly difficult to do.
Yeah. Well, that's fair enough. I'm glad you're still busy. Mark Bradshaw, you're in the similar sort of Labour political boat, aren't you? But in what way is your role different from Steve's?
Well, I'm a backbencher, but I've spent quite a lot of my 11 years on the council doing various jobs. So I've been a cabinet member three times. I've chaired a scrutiny commission. I've chaired the West of England Scrutiny Commission, which is the four authorities working together, which is really, really important. And I suppose a lot of my time has been really involved on transport and place, which is really planning and property and environment.
Yeah, that's a really bizarre name, isn't it? The place. They have a member for place. What does that mean? I mean,
it works for me, because I've spent a lot of that time working not only on transport but with colleagues in planning, property, environment, and when you bring them all together, that's where you get the greatest benefit for local people. It's not just the physical build, it's the services and the quality of those services. So place for me, and it's a common theme now across Britain, you know, if you go to other cities, you'll find these services are kind of organised around a place team. It kind of works well.
Okay. I think if you ask the man on the street, what does place mean in the context? It's a bit of a weird name, isn't it, to choose?
I couldn't come up with another alternative on a Friday afternoon. I would struggle.
Now, you used to have responsibility for transport, is that right?
Yeah, I've done the transport brief either on its own in my most recent incarnation or as part of a wider portfolio. Three times now, so you know, I feel quite attached to the various transport issues in the city, rightly or wrongly.
Well, yes, indeed. I was going to say, I mean, what was your role or responsibility with regards to Metrobus?
Well, I just knew you were going to ask about Metrobus. I can never do an interview without being asked about Metrobus. Look, it's a 10-year programme from when a piece of work was done looking at the city region and how people were going to move around the city region over the next 20 years, to bids going into government. I think the first proposal kind of appeared around 2005. I came in as a councillor 2006, was in the cabinet 2007. Different administrations have worked on this. I think there's been about five cabinet members of different parties who've worked on this. You know, it's been a real trial for the city. I suppose my frustration is wanting to see it in operation, because I believe that once it works and people can use it and experience it for their daily journeys, a lot of the criticism will begin to evaporate. But the longer it takes to get it running, the more the criticism grows. And I can understand it. You know, I use the bus most days myself. I want to be able to use Metrobus as part of my journey.
Are you confident that when it's up and running, it will be seen as representing good value for money?
I think what it will do is it will help people to make journeys that at the moment are very difficult to make by public transport. There are some journeys. You know, I've got constituents, for example, who work up on the North Fringe in, say, Filton, and really struggle. They feel compelled to drive, because doing the journey by public transport means multiple changes of different modes of transport and tickets and the rest of it. So the simplicity of being able to do new journeys, better quality vehicles, so taking a lot of the polluting diesels out and replacing them with newer buses, eventually I hope biogas, making it easy to pay for journeys and plan journeys. You know, these are all positive things. in transport, and particularly transport infrastructure, you don't get anything on the cheap.
Well, indeed, but that was the whole point of Metrobus, wasn't it?
Never going to be cheap.
Well, you say that. I mean, the government wanted a guided bus because it was cheaper than a railed vehicle. Isn't that the background to this?
Not necessarily. There were all sorts of appraisals done around, you know, a bus-type vehicle compared to tram, light rail, trolley bus, every kind of iteration that was around at the time. And the bus network came out tops of all those evaluations that were done. I tell you what really happened. Around 2010, a lot of the capital programmes when the coalition government came in lost their funding. I think Metrobus, we lost about 10% of our funding. And that money specifically was around much more guideway. So right. We've ended up with much less guideway than was originally intended, and that funding has never been able to be put back into the scheme.
Yeah, well, George Ferguson cut out some of the guideway, didn't he? The bit that was going to use the Harbour Railway.
But that was small compared. You know, I worked with George in his multi-party cabinet, and I can tell you that the real difficulties were around 2010 when I was in opposition. I was chair of scrutiny, and we found that actually a lot of the capital programmes were being cut. I think we had a 10% cut, which was basically a lot of the additional guideway just went overnight.
Okay.
I still think it would be a good scheme for Bristol, but don't think of it as the silver bullet, but think of it as a contribution to helping people make a daily journey.
Yeah. Now, what is the latest sort of transport controversy is Marvin's supposed underground railway, which I think isn't going to be an underground railway at all, or possibly only slightly. But, you know, I'm wondering whether it's significant that, you know, we're talking about new... possibly in the light of how Metrobus hasn't quite gone to plan, that we're talking about a new rail system rather than a new Metrobus route.
I think that, you know, if you look at most cities, and I've spent a lot of time looking at different places and talking to counterparts both across Britain and Europe in particular, it's the combination of networks. It's the bus plus rail plus tram, walking routes and cycling routes, you know, quality walking routes and cycling routes. It's how they all come together as part of a network. So if you were to say to me, let's put some significant money into upgrading the Severn Beach line, the Portishead line, which hopefully is going to happen at some stage, and the new Henbury line, let's beef them up into higher frequency kind of urban transit. And in order to do that, some of it may need to go into shallow tunnels, as is quite possible. I can really see that happening, particularly if it connects Bristol to the airport. And we know the airport wants to expand quite significantly over the next 20 years.
But it's on the top of a hill, isn't it?
Yeah. But in terms of engineering, you know, there are ways of overcoming that. Now, that for me is a different concept from saying Bristol's going to get... For those of your listeners who are familiar with London, the Jubilee line or the Northern line, which I don't think is on the cards at all. And I think it's the precision with which you explain these things and how it fits in with what else you're doing. That's my take. I'm not right. Close to this anymore. I'm on the back benches.
Yeah. But are you glad you're on the back benches now?
I think I've done my bit.
Okay. Steve, you were giving me a sort of wry smile when I raised the rail versus metro bus point.
Yeah.
He's shaking his head there.
No, I've got to say, I will hold my hands up and say that I wasn't a fan of metro bus. The more I've got involved with it, the keener I am on it. It's a lot of money. And if you think of it as only providing additional bus services, then you've got entirely the wrong idea about it. It is going to be a rapid system. More interestingly is, although it's called a metro bus system, we're getting an awful lot of infrastructure out of it. So we've got a lot of bridges built. We've got a lot of additional cycleways put in. We've we've got a lot of additional flood protection put in for the centre of town as a result of this. All things that it would have been much more difficult to get funding for if they hadn't been piggybacked onto the Metro bus scheme.
So,
as far as Marvin's Underground goes,
yeah,
the problem we make with these things is when anybody mentions the word underground, everybody thinks underground. Oh, that's like London then.
Yeah.
And actually, most of London's underground isn't underground. And most of Bristol's underground
won't be
underground either. Yeah. I mean, some of it in the middle of town will have to be because there isn't enough space on the surface to put this stuff in.
No. When you were talking about how you were able to sort of piggyback other infrastructure works on Metrobus.
Are you going to ask me, was that deceitful?
No. I was going to use the phrase, but I was going to say, in a good way, in a sort of honest way, is it a kind of Trojan horse to sort of get other things done?
In a good way. I mean, the term Trojan horse is a bit pejorative.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And that's why you used it.
No, I was always going to qualify it.
But yes, an awful lot of stuff has been added in that shows real benefit for local people without them actually realising, oh, that was Metrobus did that. I mean, people look at all of the roadworks that are going on around town at the moment and they think, oh, that's Metrobus doing that. But some of it has been, but a lot of it hasn't. And the stuff around Temple Gate at the moment and Temple Circus, I mean, that's not a Metrobus thing at all. Metrobus happens to be getting the blame for it.
Do you think either of you we will see a sort of universal Oyster card or something similar for Bristol Transport?
I think Oyster card has been superseded. The technology in terms of how people pay for their journeys is just in a different place than it was just a few years ago when we were talking about cards. Now you can, I can use my phone to pay for my train journey. You've got M-Tickets and Apple Pay and Android Pay.
You still need a sort of integrated business model of some sort to give you those sort of discounts and connectivity, don't you?
I think we're all across integrated. We all of us want to see integrated public transport. Mm. We all want to see that. And really, there's three things you need for integrated public transport. You need to bring all of the modes together. So the bus stops have to be close to the train stations.
Yeah.
And so do the taxi stands and all the rest of it. You need them physically close together. You need information about them all in one place so that it's easier to plan your journey before you make it or to change your journey when you're partway through it. And you also need one ticket. And I think that is the closest thing to a magic bullet, is one ticket that you can use. And there are tickets that you can use on the train and on the local buses as well. But a lot of these things aren't as well publicised as they need to be.
Yeah.
And that perhaps is our biggest failing.
Right.
I mean, we probably ought to hold our hands up for that and say, you know what, we need to publicise this stuff better.
And I think also a further ingredient, which is entirely possible, when I was talking to Transport for London and MasterCard and others, is to help people to have confidence that if they need to, for example, change buses or move from bus to train, that their fares are going to be capped, as you have in London. So it's entirely possible with software and a tweak to the system to give people that confidence to make the daily journeys, weekly journeys, and not be worried that they're racking up some huge bill. And that, for me, is a very important part of the equality of travel, that everybody should have access to travel. They shouldn't be put off of making sometimes complicated journeys because they're worried about the bill at the end of the day, the end of the week. And that's a component that I've been very keen on over the years, and I think it's entirely doable.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on from transport, at least for the time being. The big story locally, of course, was the budget, and Marvin Rees, I think, has succeeded in getting budget through and getting rid of some amendments. The Liberal Democrats are not happy, the Greens are not happy, but I'm going to invite Martin first, just to give us a sort of a national context of why we're in this situation where we've got to make budget cuts and whose fault is it, really?
Well, I mean, the situation for Labour councils and in major cities is the same as everywhere else. But they can't make illegal budgets. Nobody's proposing that. Therefore, we're forced to make cuts, which we don't want to make. I'm afraid of some of the rhetoric that's come from Marvin. I find that we know we're going to treat this as an opportunity and that we're going to empower people. I don't really buy into that. I think we've got to be straight with people. It's a blood, sweat and tears approach. You've just got to say to people, we don't want to do this, but we've got to do it. What shall we cut? And really, we need a change of government and a change of policy. And everybody, I think, agrees with that.
Yeah. So you're suggesting, and I suspect that Steve and Mark will agree, that you know, Marvin had sort of no choice at all, really, or very little room for manoeuvre.
Well, I think there's obviously going to be room for people to say, to disagree with the particular approach that's taken, and clearly the Liberal Democrats and the Greens have. But I think the idea of dipping into the reserves, which the Greens have pushed,
right,
is you know, you can only do that once,
yeah,
and then it's gone.
Yeah.
And now there's a case to be made. If the government was going to fall quickly, then you could take a risk. But I don't think we can take that risk. And
no,
I think it's reasonable
no.
for Marvin to say, look, we're not going to dig into the reserves in those circumstances.
OK, the Lib Dems claim our proposal would have put money back into key frontline services, libraries, parks and adult social care. Labour nationally has said that austerity is a choice. The mayor insists he has no options. We offered him a choice and he spurned it. What choice did the Lib Dems amendment offer? And why did you spurn it?
Well, we thought it was a bit rich for the Lib Dems to lecture us on austerity, given that they were part of the government that brought it in. And,
yeah.
and
they could,
you know,
have ended it. They could have ended it like that.
And just didn't. And were cheerleaders. You know, if you look back at people like David Laws and Nick Clegg, they were cheerleaders for austerity, although now they kind of say that it wasn't really their fault. So we thought that was a bit rich. And I think the Lib Dem amendment was a fantasy one, kind of conjuring up money through contingencies. Now, you know, as I've said to you, I've spent a lot of my time working on big infrastructure projects and services. I know the value of contingencies, that often they're really, really crucial, because you find stuff that you just hadn't planned for and you need to deal with it quickly.
Yeah, well, like, when you say contingency, what exactly do you mean? Are you talking about having a bit of spare money in the bank for a rainy day?
No, this is a legitimate amount that you hold back on major projects, for example,
right,
in case there's additional costs or additional pressures that you face. And this often is how it happens in real life.
Right.
The Lib Dems, I think, correct me if I've got this wrong, Steve, wanted to basically strip out a lot of the contingencies as a kind of windfall, which is, I think, quite illusory. And the Greens, you know, they put up four amendments, which were good quality amendments. We supported three of them. Then they voted against the budget as a whole. They voted against their own amendments.
Well, yeah, but weren't they trying to make the best of a bad deal, as it
no,
were?
No.
Yeah.
They should have accepted that actually three of the four amendments, in our view, were really good quality amendments and were affordable and doable, and we wanted to support them in that. We voted for them, and they voted against
it. Yeah, but it's quite reasonable to say, look, this is a bad deal. We're going to try and make it slightly less of a bad deal, but we still think it's a bad deal and we don't like it.
No, it's just plain politics. It's plain politics.
I think that they wanted to play politics, but they were actually very happy that the Labour members in the council chamber salvaged their amendments for them.
Yeah. Okay.
And we did like some of their amendments. There was at least one of them that actually, I'm a little bit sick that we didn't think proper ourselves.
Well, there was investing in a children's home. There was increasing the charges for commercial developers in terms of skips and scaffolding that impinge on the road. And there was the appointment of a planning officer for 6 months to look at the impact of university growth on the city and the growth in student numbers. All very plausible, important issues that we supported and backed. And say good quality amendments.
Yeah, just going back to what Martin said earlier about you know, you can gamble on the Conservative government not lasting very long, and I suspect you might get a fairly short price on it, but nonetheless, you can't bank on it. How long is this Conservative government going to last? How is it going to pan out, do you think, before the next election or until the next election?
Well, I'm going to keep looking at Mark's phone here, because I'm expecting You know what? There could be a news flash any time, couldn't there? The problem is they might very well drag on until 2022.
Yeah.
They don't want a general election. And I guess they'll probably swallow everything they have to in order to make sure that Jeremy Corbyn doesn't stand a chance of getting into number 10.
Yeah, which, you know, his critics would argue that he might not anyway. And the Conservatives, you know, I think even the most impartial observer would say they're divided, they're not doing very well, you know, Theresa May isn't a great Prime Minister, and yet you look at the opinion polls, they're neck and neck. Why isn't Jeremy Corbyn 20 points ahead in the polls?
Well, we've all learned not to put too much faith into opinion polls over the years, but I think for me the greatest disappointment is you've got a government which is very weak, which is divided, dependent on the Ulster Unionists, and preoccupied totally and absolutely with Brexit and the different shades of Brexit that different members of the cabinet want to see or don't want to see. And there's some real massive challenges in the country which are largely being ignored. And it's this sense of inertia. And do we have to go through this all the way to 2021, 22? Or is there a better way of getting housing fixed? You know, in Bristol, we're about to face more universal credit. You know, all these are real life pressures on so many people. And yet Brexit is just absorbing every ounce of energy that this weak government has.
They're not interested in anything else, frankly, and they're certainly not doing the important work that government ought to be doing to make ordinary people's lives better.
Yeah. Having said that,
and I have to say that when my opponent is making a mistake, Napoleon said this: never interrupt your opponent when he's making a mistake.
Well, yes, but does Labour want to win the next election? Because they will be handed a poison chalice of the post-Brexit shambles. Is there a side of you that's tempted to say, well, you know, you created this mess, you sort it out?
I think a Labour government under any circumstances is better than a Tory government under those same circumstances. And I want a general election tomorrow.
Right, OK.
I think having seen a Labour government, the difference, you know, Sure Start, for example, which I know is often touted, but has made a real positive difference to so many children and their families. And I see the difference that a progressive Labour government would make as opposed to this very stale and static one that we currently have.
Yeah. Martin?
Well, I think because Brexit dominates the news agenda, and most people aren't that interested in politics, they don't follow it, they just pick up, you know, what the mainstream is talking about. And Brexit dominates the agenda, and quite a lot of people voted to leave the EU, and therefore, they've soaked up the UKIP vote, the Tories, basically. UKIP's collapsed, you know, they're in total disarray. And they had 4 million votes, if you remember, and that's all gone. What actually happened at the last election is both the Labour and Tory share of the votes went up. But the Labour vote went up by more, which is why they were snookered into doing a deal with the DUP.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you actually look at this, this is a very, very, very fraught constitutional crisis is just around the corner, because they've already agreed with the EU 27 that there's got to be regulatory alignment between north and south of the Irish border. Now, that implies, at the very least, a customs union. But, of course, they're coming out this week, in the last 24 hours, saying that they're against a customs union. Well, Anna Soubry and Kenneth Clark are not against a customs union. And their votes will out, and the DUP isn't clear. I mean, the DUP are in schizophrenia about this. They don't want a hard border, but they don't want special deals for their own, you know, for Northern Ireland. No. So therefore, they're holding the Tory coalition to ransom, because it's got to be the same deal for them as the rest of the country. So if the DUP has to have a soft border, which means a soft Brexit, that means that the right wing of the Tory party has got to accept a soft Brexit, unless the DUP, unless they can force a hard Brexit through with the support of the DUP, because they're split.
Yeah.
But then they lose their own left wing, the Soubrys and the Clarks, and they won't have the votes. As George Osborne said, the first thing you've got to do if you're going to be Prime Minister is you've got to be able to count.
It's a circle that's impossible to square, isn't it?
I accept that, you know, the majority of people voted to leave the EU and you know, that's where we are. But if you put jobs and future prospects and the economy first, then you really have to look at a frictionless border between the UK and the EU countries. We do 60% plus of our trade with those countries, in some sectors of the economy much, much more. And if those wanting to export are stuck at the airport or stuck at Dover with piles of different papers, forms to be stamped, you can just see it, because that's how it used to be. And we moved away from that. And there are some, I believe, in the Tory party who want to go back to that and really don't care. They've got some kind of ideological fixation about the hard Brexit, sharp Brexit. They really don't care. But if you talk to business in particular, most business organisations, and I used to work for Federation, will tell you that the customs union or some equivalent of it is really quite crucial. And that's apart from all the impact on healthcare. You know, in the Commons this week, there was a discussion about Euratom and access to medical isotopes, which are really crucial for cancer treatment. You know, this has so many different angles to it.
Yeah, and if what you were saying about, you know, commerce and business wanting this frictionless border, one imagines that the Tory party is the voice of commerce, isn't it? So why isn't big business bending the Tory party's arm to say, look, we must have the customs union?
I personally think it's a choice between the Tories wanting to stay in office or really accepting the reality. And they're so split. And you saw the Chequers, the photo of them sat round the same table. Now, I was amazed they could all sit round the same table, and there weren't three or four tables, you know, where they, you know.
Government breakout group. Firstly, I'm really pleased it's not my job to sort this mess out. A plague on all their houses. I wouldn't know where to begin, and that's why I'm a councillor rather than a national politician.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go back to some local issues. Let's talk about homelessness, because I read that Bristol is going to build 3,500 homes. You'll forgive me for being a little bit sceptical, because, you know, everyone promises loads of new housing, and is this going to materialise, and who's going to pay for it, and will it be affordable?
We, Marvin, promised 2,000 homes, 800 of which would be affordable by 2020, and we're comfortably on target to beat that.
Right.
3,500, I think that's probably the top end of the range of what we might build. And of course, they're not built, they're not useful until someone's got the front door key, are they?
No.
But we're moving in the right direction. We're building more affordable houses now than we were when we came in. And developers have got the message that when we say we want affordable houses, they got to build them. We did some really good things. Paul Smith, our cabinet member for housing, did some good things when he stopped selling off council housing, and he stopped selling off our property and started using that as leverage with developers to make sure that we started delivering on housing and delivering on affordable housing, and a willingness, a preparedness to say, if you're not going to build what we need, we'll do a deal with somebody else.
You make it sound so easy, but why have previous administrations failed to do this?
I don't know. I'm not responsible for them.
I think it's economic cycles. You know, I had the housing brief for 6 months or so, 6 months to a year under George Ferguson. And, you know, the kind of economy was very different. Projects were slipping. Developers were pulling out of schemes. you found that the leverage of Rhyfel land, because the council still owns a lot of land, was not as viable and was not as strong as it now is. And I think you know, Steve Pearce, my colleague here, is quite right that Paul Smith, who you know leads on this from within the Mayor's Cabinet, is a very powerful advocate and has got things done. He's a housing expert. He's really pushed the market. And I think part of this for me is giving clarity to the development industry that if you want to build in Bristol, this is the expectation. To back that up with the planning process, because of course these are schemes that need to go through planning, which is a democratic process. But actually, from day one, if you want to build in Bristol, whether it's a residential scheme or a mixed scheme, this is the expectation. You know, in my own ward, subject to planning, there are there's a scheme going forward for about 150 new homes. A significant number of those will be affordable. And I mean affordable because this is a word often misused and abused.
Well, yeah, because there's no... Is there a rigid definition? Can you...
Well, there is a definition that the old Housing Communities Agency used to use, which was 80% of market rent, which for most people is not affordable.
No.
Council homes is more like 50 or 60%. And significant number of the ones that I've mentioned in my own ward coming forward will be council homes. They'll be affordable for people on modest incomes. You know, let's not forget that the average household income in Bristol is still about £25,000-£26,000.
Right. You described the planning process there as democratic, but it, I mean, it isn't really, is it? It's all down to very much stacked in favour of the developers, and it seems to be like who can afford the most expensive lawyers, really. So, I mean, how can the council, in that context, get what it wants?
I meant democratic in terms of elected members making the decision.
Right.
That's what I meant. I think Paul's done a really key thing in getting viability statements to be published. I know other authorities have been trying to do this for so long, but you know, often you would hear a developer say, well, look, I'm sorry, but I can't afford to provide any affordable homes because I paid too much for the site. Well, really sorry, but if you're going to build in Bristol, you need to provide the affordable homes.
But yeah, but this
publishing
is where,
these is a really, really important step, I think.
But this is where the lawyers come in. You know, I mean, it happened with the Finsel's Reach, didn't it? The developer sort of pulled out of their affordable commitment, and it seemed at the time that the council was powerless to hold them to it.
It's I think that there are different things that the planning committees can do. For example, I was on planning committee for about a year. I've tended to work more on the policy side than on the planning committee side, but we put triggers into the consent. So at certain time periods, you would look at it again and see how the viability had changed. And that, for me, was a really good way of dealing with schemes that, on day one, were maybe kind of weak in terms of viability, but you knew jolly well, because of the prices of the properties they were selling, that by, say, year five, there would be more viability in the scheme. So I think there are different things that you can do to make sure that contribution comes through.
Are these proposed houses on brownfield sites? Because there was Marvin a while back was talking about developing that whole area around Hotwells, around the Cumberland Basin, which includes quite a lot of green space.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but I know the scheme in my ward has been earmarked for housing for a long time, is in the plan, it's in the site allocations document, which is part of the plan, and it's ready to go subject to planning. I think within Bristol there's a lot of space that we could use better. There's a lot of, you know, I know the term brownfield is often used, but there's a lot of legacy land that we could use better to create better places for people in which to live, with better links for transportation and better green space. You know, that's been my view. I know there's consultation at the moment on the density and often paraphrases to taller buildings, but actually for me is about putting these components together in a better way.
Yeah. Isn't this all, though, a little bit... I mean, okay, it's a step in the right direction, but it's a drop in the ocean. I'm reading today about Bristol Rough Sleepers and, you know, it's freezing out there right now. There's a real problem, and there's emergency measures being taken to accommodate rough sleepers. But, you know, it's kind of not good enough in the longer term, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. I understand that the emergency accommodation measures were triggered last night because it was so cold, and I expect they'll probably be in for at least another week because we're told to expect a lot more cold weather. But a lot of this is being caused by a dysfunctional private rented sector market where agents are telling landlords that, you know, you can get more money for this property. I mean, if you evict the current tenants, you can charge the next tenants more money. And the most common reason that people end up homeless now is because they've been evicted by a private sector landlord who wants more rent. Mm. And housing is a disaster in Bristol. We're building them as quick as we can. Mm. But housing is a disaster in Bristol. And if it was quick, we'd wave a magic wand and magic all of that away.
Can I just make one point about universal credit? I mean, there's been a massive increase in measured homelessness since this recent Tory government came to power. We're talking about tens of thousands of people around the country, and it's directly to do with the universal credits rules, which will not allow landlords to be paid directly as they used to be under housing benefit. And private sector landlords from the very get-go of universal credit said, well, in that case, not only are we not going to rent to people on universal credit, we're going to evict our existing tenants and bring in people who are in work, for example, rather than... Now, that's a simple thing to fix. Mm. You just go back to the old system where landlords were paid directly. But they won't do it because Ian Duncan Smith thought of the brilliant idea that we're going to get all of these people with mental health issues and drug problems to manage their own money as part of their rehabilitation. But of course the private sector landlords aren't prepared to go along with that, and that means there's been a massive increase in people being made homeless as a result of an administrative decision, leaving aside the fact that there isn't enough low-cost housing and hasn't been, because for 30 years local councils have been bullied by central government about what they can do with their own resources. When Paul Smith's been on this programme, he said by the end of my time there will be less people in social housing in Bristol than at the beginning, because people have been given the right to buy their own properties at less than market value, which again is more handouts by central government in order to try and win votes with taxpayers' money. It's been going on for 30 years, and because it's been going on for 30 years, we've now got a massive housing crisis. Mm. But it's quite clear where it came from, and it's partly to do with 13 years of Labour government not changing the rules for local councils.
And an awful lot of those council houses that were sold under right to buy are now actually private rented sector housing,
no longer available to people.
No longer available to people who actually on universal credit and desperately need it.
So these houses, the proportion of those houses which will be for rent as council houses, are you actually even keeping up with the loss, or are you just
Paul's already been quite clear about that.
You build them. You know, I looked at some figures when I was doing the job a couple of years ago, and the depressing thing was that we were building, you know, a relatively small number at the time, and Paul's doing much better at this, but compared to previous years, you know, much greater numbers, and we were losing them because sort of things we were building, houses with gardens for families, which are things that you want to build, were the most attractive to right to buy. And of course people come in with all sorts of inherited rights if they've lived in council properties before, and of course the real pressure that's coming is going to happen over the next year or so is the government's mad proposal to extend right to buy to housing associations.
Yeah.
We've all been depending on housing associations to provide the affordable housing that we haven't been able to build, and now that's going to be under threat as well.
Yeah. I think it's extraordinary that housing associations, which are supposedly independent of government, are being told by government what they can do with their own assets.
And we've got to sell our highest value council homes when they become vacant to fund the housing association right to buy. How perverse is that? really.
You couldn't make it up, could you? Martin, is there anything else on a sort of national perspective that, that we need to be doing, you know, to sort of, you know...
Well, housing is obviously key to the macroeconomy, you know. One of the things, if we get a Labour government, they're going to do is they're going to make housing a central focus, because you can put people to work building all these houses. Yeah, and, of course, it's not just a question of building houses. We've got existing stock that could be used. It's not a question of... It's not really a supply and demand problem. It's a speculation problem. And, you know, in one of the things that, that used to be true in Britain and is still true in Holland and so on, is it's the unimproved value of the land that you pay for when you take it over. Yeah, so that what happens now when you put a permission to build something on it, the price of the land goes straight up, and that goes straight into the pocket of the landowners.
Yeah.
That's not allowed in Holland.
So how does it work in Holland?
Made from the, sorry?
How does it work in Holland?
Well, in Holland, of course, a lot of the land has been rescued from the sea by the efforts of people, so it's not regarded as some kind of right that's inherent in the ownership and so on. And they're just more robust about it. It used to be the same in Britain until 1962. I was reading earlier. That's how they built all the new towns.
Okay.
Because when they said we're going to build this here, they buy it at its existing agricultural value.
Yeah.
And that's it.
So if I own a plot of land in the Netherlands and I get planning permission for it, that planning permission increases the value of my land. So do they tax me on that?
Well, no, what they do is that don't forget that they, I mean, around Stockholm in Sweden, for example, after the war, the Swedish, the Stockholm Council bought all the land around Stockholm, a whole lot, as agricultural land at unimproved value, and then they built these state-of-the-art suburbs to house people.
Yeah.
Even the Prime Minister lived in council housing in Sweden. Yeah. He's got his key. When he got on the list, he got his key and all the rest of it.
That is so Swedish, isn't it? That's so
well, it's going to be the same thing. That's why they're in much colder climes. They don't have people sleeping on the streets because they've had a sensible policy for decades.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the homeless thing. I mean, do we have in Bristol an empty homes problem? Is there a significant amount of just vacant property that can't be made available?
I think Paul Smith's done a great job in just getting... empty council properties back into use for much more quickly, and to be credit, to give credit, I think the previous Lib Dem administration had done some good work in this, and including private property that is left vacant, because sometimes there's an issue when the previous owner dies and there's a court process around who owns the property, and this can take years. And I encountered one in Southmead where the property had been empty for about 10 years, and we managed to get some government funding to actually buy the property, do it up, and then rent it back as a social rented home. So there are issues in the market, but I think we've got a better... I can't recall the figure, but we're doing better in terms of getting our empty properties back to be relet much quicker, and actually targeting those properties that have been empty for a significantly long time. And as Steve said, not selling off properties, but refurbishing them and bring them back up to decent home standard.
Yeah, you're very. I've noticed you're praising the work of Paul Smith. He's a Labour councillor, is he?
Yeah, but he's massively enthusiastic about this stuff, and you can see a real difference. You know, I'm not part of the Paul Smith fan club, but you can see a real difference that he's made.
Yeah,
because
that's right.
He's got this real experience that you can see.
I think a key thing is they're not selling all the land that's owned by the council is going to be developed by the council, and set up their own vehicle to do that. Which means that, you know, you're in the driving seat in a way that was not the case previously.
You're cutting out. So okay, that makes perfect sense. So in terms of going back to the homeless problem, is it just about the availability of accommodation, or there are other factors involved? I don't know, drugs or whatever, or mental health? Maybe you don't know.
Well, yes, there is, obviously. I mean, people end up homeless on the street. Nobody wants to end up there, but they do end up there. But as I said earlier, Steve... The increase in homelessness since this government came to power is enormous, yeah, and that's definitely to do with the administration of universal credit.
Right.
And it can be changed just like that. I mean, if the Tories had any sense, they'd say, right, we'll scrap that. Do you know why they can't change it? Because of the delicate balance of power within the Tory party, Ian Duncan Smith being a Brexiteer and so on, it would fly in the face, basically saying, you got that wrong.
Right. Yeah,
we've had 6 years of a silly policy, we've got to change it. But that would make him look bad. But he can't be allowed to look bad.
He's no longer in charge of that, though, is he?
No, he isn't in charge of it, but he's still got influence over it from the back seat.
And he's very clearly identified with
that. Yes, he's identified. But, I mean, the reason we haven't been able to roll it out...
Face is everything in this cabinet at the moment.
Yeah, and because of the delicate balance of forces that they have, they can't afford to mess, to snook anybody's, cock anybody's snook. not to put too fine a point on it.
Snook anybody's cock either.
I tell you what is telling. Each couple of months or so, there's an early morning's census of the homeless that you can find, because obviously a lot of people, you just find it difficult to find. And of course the kind of instance of rough sleeping is just spread beyond the city centre where it used to be more focused. And you just see so many different circumstances, from people who have been homeless for a long time, sometimes ex-service people, sometimes with inherent mental health issues or drug addiction or alcohol addiction. But you see the fragility of the private tenancy world, where it doesn't take much to tip someone out of a home. Maybe a relationship has broken down, or maybe, as has been said, a private landlord says, I want you out unless you can pay an extra £1,000 a month. And we've done we've all done casework on this, and it is heartbreaking when you know that often, if it's a family affected, they're going to end up in bed and breakfast, often in a different part of the city, going to a different school, and having their whole lives turned upside down, with all the consequential impact on their mental health and well-being as well, which, has an impact on them, but has a cost impact on the public sector. It is ludicrous what is happening, and I fear it's going to get much worse.
And the frightening thing is that everybody is just a couple of paychecks away from being homeless. So it's not just the people that actually are homeless now, but there's an awful lot of people that are on that boundary.
Well, also think about how much people are having to spend of their income on housing.
Yeah.
I mean, people on low incomes, it's more than half their budget.
But isn't there something shocking about even people who are in work have no savings virtually?
That's why I say two paychecks away from homelessness.
It's a very fragile existence.
Let's touch on a couple of other Bristol-related stories. What are we going to do about the bear pit? Blank looks all round.
We've all spent a lot of money on the bear pit over the years. When I took on the transport job, my predecessor had done a scheme on the bear pit. I did some more work on it. I think my successors did. I don't think there is a clear answer, but I think, my own personal view is that there comes a point where there's no public money left to spend on it, because other priorities are biting so much. So I don't kind of know how far we are from that, but my own perspective is you've probably spent enough on it.
Right.
Over a period of time and various schemes, the bear pit has changed out of all recognition. However, we've still got enduring problems there. And the one thing that hasn't changed is that the bear pit is at a different level to all the other areas around it. And that lends to isolation. And anywhere that's isolated from everywhere else, different conditions are going to exist in that environment. So,
but also
agreeing with Mark, I think at some point we have to say, all of the things we've tried haven't worked. So we need to try something that's radically different and perhaps do away with the pit.
Well, fill it in.
Yeah. And we did this in Old Market with the subways, because we got so many complaints about them being, really dangerous places for people to go. And we did some consultation. I think I was in office at the time, and we decided, to block it up. There was a subway, one particular one, that was a problem. And I just observe, you know, just being somebody, you know, walking around the centre at times, and you see the difference, because we put some new surface level crossings around the edge of the bear pit, new cycleway, but actually new surface crossings. The number of people who now use those surface crossings rather than going underneath to cross over what is a very busy road. Yeah. And that for me is quite telling, that more and more people are avoiding it. But businesses are closing, I think, A, because of the atmosphere, but also because they're perhaps not getting enough trade.
Yeah.
Because people are not going
down
there.
People are avoiding it, yeah. I mean, to take us full circle, we could put an underground station in the bear pit and then fill it in over the top.
Maybe that's not such a crazy idea.
And we're back at 5 past 6.
The 1960s sort of, you know, urban nirvana planning theory was that you separate out cars from pedestrians, you know, so that they don't interfere with each other. Why doesn't that work?
Well, It doesn't lead to an integrated city, and we've spent a lot of money and time over the years taking apart this concrete kind of world that people in the 60s and 70s thought would be the future. So, for example, that awful escalator over Old Market, we've managed to take down after many, many years of trying to do it. And you see what difference that makes in terms of integrating Old Market, Castle Park and the centre. Yeah. So we've... And around Nelson Street with the old courts complex, and, you know, this kind of level environment, whereas actually you want people to be integrated, you want to make it easy for people to move around, people with mobility issues to make it easy for them to do their daily business, go around shops and go to work. And actually, this kind of architectural vision of the future is just gone, I think. But it's costly taking it apart. It's right. Really costly taking
it was
apart.
Costly putting it up, yeah.
And costly
and it
taking
proved
it apart.
Costly taking it
it's
down
It's a concrete
again.
World that you need to physically take apart.
Yeah.
So we can tick that box. We tried that experiment.
Tried that, didn't work.
It
yeah.
didn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm predicting we'll be saying the same about Metrobus in 10 years. But I may be wrong. I don't know. But
well, the thing about Metrobus is we've committed so much to doing it now. There's absolutely no point in not finishing it off. Yeah, I mean, even it's like nuclear power. Even if nuclear power's not making money, you don't close it down until you're not covering your variable costs, you know.
Well,
once you've done it, you've done it.
I think that's a bit debatable, isn't it? Yeah, because nuclear power is sort of monstrously expensive, and the cost of the waste is sort of...
I mean, the point I'm making is that when you've committed to doing something... I mean, nuclear power isn't viable, really, but once you've got nuclear power stations, you might as well run them to the end of their natural life, and that, because, you've got to get something back for the money you've invested.
Unless they're running at a loss. Gentlemen, we've got 2 minutes left. I've got a couple more Bristol stories, which, if you're going to hang around after the news, or do you want to quickly tackle? I know... The motorbike torchings, because those of us, you know, who've seen it, who like motorbikes, this poor old guy has his motorbike stolen and torched and held to random, and the police have come in from a lot of abuse. Do you think the police have done all they can? Is there anything else that they should or could have done on this one?
I'm a biker.
Right.
I hate to see bikes torched, really.
Bad idea.
It's always a bad idea. I feel sorry for anyone who's lost a bike to that. I've had bikes stolen myself, and it's never pleasant. Could they have done more? You know what? They probably could, but they have cost pressures and they have other things to do as well. So, I mean, it's always difficult to... The poor copper's never gonna get a fair crack of the whip on this one. You know, people are going to say, well, why are they off doing that? Why aren't they doing this instead? Why are they dealing with bikes when they could be dealing with my burglary? Why are they dealing with that when they could be dealing with... with rapes and fights in the centre and things like that.
Yeah, why haven't they caught him yet? Okay, the news is coming up in about 10 seconds' time. I'm with Mark Bradshaw and Steve Pearce and Martin Summers, and maybe we'll talk some more after the news. And I'm Steve Satan, by the way, sitting in for Tony Gosling.
is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.